Murkowski challenge. Murkowski challenge. Murkowski challenge.
Keeping a sharp eye on the write-in vote count. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 10th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, speaking out on Chukchi Sea oil exploration.
Pretty much all of our buildings, our roads, our bridges, they've been provided by oil and gas revenues.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Division of Elections today began counting the write-in votes cast in last week's general election. 30 election officials in 15 teams of two began sorting and counting the ballots in a former print shop on the waterfront in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The task is to determine if enough voters wrote Lisa Murkowski on their ballots to give her victory in the race for the U.S. Senate. Those election workers doing the counting were joined by about 50 observers representing all political parties and candidates. The early results show Lisa Murkowski clearly is getting 89% of the write-in vote. However,
Murkowski challenge. Murkowski challenge. Murkowski.
I'm sure there's a
Murkowski challenge. Murkowski challenge. Murkowski challenge.
Elections Director Gail Fanumiai personally looking at every challenged ballot and making a determination of whether the vote should be accepted or rejected. As Lisa Murkowski has the vast majority of the write-in votes, nearly 9% will be allowed for her despite being challenged. Those challenged but counted ballots were questioned by the Miller supporters for a variety of reasons, misspelling the name being the most common. But Fanumiai has to determine the voter's intention.
If I can phonetically pronounce the name by the way it's spelt, that's the standard I'm using. And some of them look like they are spelt perfectly fine to me, and they're challenging them, and I think it's a handwriting issue.
Many of the ballots, however, were easy to reject. The oval beside the name was not filled in. The vote was for Frank Murkowski, and some were totally illegible. However, Fanumiai was accepting names ending in SKY, or beginning MER. She was also accepting Murkowski, Lisa, and most of those were challenged. When the counting is finished, the results will show the number of unchallenged write-ins, along with the number of those challenged but ruled for Murkowski. Fanumiai says those will be kept apart.
They remain sealed in an envelope, so they don't get commingled with the rest of the ballots. In case there's future challenges in court down the road after certification is done.
Campaign staff for both Murkowski and Miller are watching the count taking place. Murkowski's spokesman John Tracy sees victory if the early results hold up.
89% of those who wrote in Lisa Murkowski's name and filled in the bubble did it absolutely correctly. The premise of Lisa Murkowski's campaign was that the voters of Alaska were entirely capable of doing this.
Miller's spokesman Randy DeSoto was not disturbed by those first numbers, however. The Miller campaign has held that the loose interpretation of voter intent is not in law, and DeSoto says the goal of the hand count is to find which votes were done correctly.
Well, our job today is just to separate out those that don't comply with the law as written, and the legislature was very clear that if it has to be as it's declared in the write-in candidacy or to have the last name spelled correctly, so that's what we're doing today.
The counting will continue with the goal of finishing by Friday. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beislein has denied a request by Joe Miller to immediately stop the count of write-in ballots. In a written decision today, Beislein said he found no reason to stop the count and Miller's complaint would be heard in due course. Miller's attorney, Thomas Van Flein, yesterday filed the lawsuit in federal court accusing Division of Elections Director Gail Fanoumiai of, quote, ignoring the provisions of state law with which she apparently disagrees and failing to provide guidance on voter intent for write-in ballots. The Miller campaign wants the division to follow state law literally and only count write-in votes where the candidate's name is spelled exactly as it appears on their declaration of candidacy. Beislein gave both sides until the middle of next week to file briefs in the lawsuit. Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell oversees Alaska elections. He says the state's position has been consistent all along that minor misspellings of a candidate's name will be counted.
That continues to be my position today, and we are proceeding with the ballot count under that direction.
Campbell is confident the court will side with the state. He says numerous cases have set precedent that elections officials have some leeway when determining voter intent.
That's probably going to be the gist of the argument, the court cases that tell us that we're supposed to look at voter intent. And in the state law, it gives the latitude for us to make sure that we're not disenfranchising voters.
He added that state law only requires write-in ballots to have the oval filled in and the candidate's full name or last name written as it appears on their declaration of candidacy.
It actually doesn't say correctly spelled. It says the last name. Some would argue, well, that means it has to be correctly spelled. Others would argue, based on the multitude of language differences we have in Alaska and the large geographical area we have, that a minor misspelling should not be penalized against a voter and cause them to be disenfranchised.
Campbell praised the election workers who have come to Juneau from around the state to participate in the write-in count. He calls it historically important. Miller has criticized having the count in Juneau, but Campbell says write-in votes have always been counted in the state capital. Plenty of people showed up at a Bureau of Ocean Energy Management public hearing in Anchorage last night. The crowd was orderly, respectful, and adamantly pro-development in its comments regarding exploratory oil drilling in the Chukchi Sea. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The office space used for the public hearing was on the ground floor of a building central to one of Anchorage's sparkling new high-rise business complexes, flanked by Arctic Slope Regional's city headquarters. Alaska, USA neon logos loomed from atop tall buildings bordering what has become the city's first cement canyon, while urban traffic zoomed by, spraying city slush across a narrow sidewalk. Trucks, SUVs, and oil-fueled vehicles of every description filed into a brightly lit parking lot where Aves Sampson waved a hand-lettered cardboard sign.
We need jobs, and we need oil, and this is what it's all about. As we're here tonight to support the opening of the Outer Continental Shelf to provide the oil that Alaska needs and the oil that the United States needs.
He wants to keep his vehicles rolling. Opponents to this point of view, one dressed as a polar bear, stood by the office door, led by the Center for Biological Diversity's Rebecca Noblin.
There are too many unknowns. Their current draft environmental impact statement is faulty. It's not complete. We can't say that drilling is safe. Right now, we know drilling is too risky. We know we can't clean an oil spill in Arctic waters, so we shouldn't be drilling there.
The two demonstrators pretty much set the tone for the evening. Inside, the room was packed, maybe 180 people, counting those standing along the walls. Most there were youthful to middle-aged, almost all Caucasian, and the larger proportion of them were male, men with families, men who wanted to keep their jobs, men who had lost their jobs due to recent economic declines, men like Rick Braun.
We became a state because we had resources sufficient to supposedly allow us to be a functioning state. We're being strangled with our resources to the point where maybe we won't function anymore and we'll be a welfare society state. Let's just get on with it. Let's approve the EIS, the supplemental EIS, the whatever EIS you come up with, and let's go do something.
And men like John Shepard.
And so I urge the Department of the Interior to affirm its previous lease sale decision and let's get started with exploration.
BOEM's Jeffrey Lohman reminded the crowd that the dispute over Chukchi exploratory drilling goes back to a 2008 lease sale, which netted the federal government $2.7 billion in lease bids. In July of this year, an Anchorage judge decided that 3 points in the federal agency's draft environmental impact statement for the lease were in dispute and remanded the sale back to the agency after the native village of Point Hope sued to stop the lease sale entirely, saying it violates the National Environmental Policy Act. The public hearing is part of the process of designing a supplemental EIS to address the court's concerns. In general, the Anchorage public was not as interested in the 3 points in dispute as they were in getting a sluggish state economy moving. Others from more northern climes voiced their opinions, too. Doris Shavings hails from Barrow and is a member of the Inupiat community of the Arctic Slope.
I grew up in the 80s and the 90s in the North Slope, and I've experienced a lot of benefits. My education, my college education, was paid for by oil and gas revenues. The infrastructure, like the schools, pretty much all of our buildings, our roads, our bridges, they've been provided by oil and gas revenues. Jobs have been provided by oil and gas revenues.
And June Childers from Wainwright.
We also must rely on jobs to support subsistence. The cost to buy gas for our boats, snow machines, and four-wheelers is high. To meet this need for income, we are keenly aware of the value of economic development in our community. For that reason, the village of Wainwright sees oil exploration in the Chukchi Sea as one of the most important opportunities we have.
Representatives of several environmental organizations that had joined the Point Hope suit were present to speak against oil drilling on the Outer Continental Shelf. Written comments on the issue will be accepted through November 30th, according to Lohman. Once they are in, the draft supplemental EIS will be sent to Interior Secretary Kenneth Salazar, who will decide what's next. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, National Guardsmen get some higher training.
As soon as I jumped out of the helicopter, the wind caught me, so I started going a lot faster.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
From Kodiak to Kosigluk to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
Juneau Representative Kathy Munoz says fellow Southeast Republican Kyle Johansson's decision to leave the House majority will hurt the region. House leaders asked Johansson to continue as majority leader next session. It's one of the chamber's top spots. But he left the caucus when Anchorage Republican Charisse Millett didn't get the Finance Committee assignment she wanted. The two have been described as having a close personal relationship. Munoz says leaving was a bad move.
I think he would have served his community and the region well if he had continued in the majority leader position. You know, I don't know where he will fit in this legislature. I'm not sure if he will even have committee assignments.
Johansson did not return phone calls, but he told Ketchikan's newspaper he left because he disagreed with the caucus's philosophical direction. Munoz is moving up a notch in the new House organization. She's taking over as sole chairwoman of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. She co-chaired the panel this past session with Bethel Democratic Representative Bob Huron, who has moved on to other posts. Munoz says she'll continue to use her position to block capital move measures.
In the previous legislature, there was one bill that was introduced that had to do with asking communities to submit ideas for capital infrastructure. That bill came to the Community in Regional Affairs Committee, and it didn't go anywhere from there.
Munoz is entering her second term representing Juneau's Mendenhall Valley and neighborhoods to the north. She says her post and those of some other Southeast lawmakers will be good for the region.
The University Lands Bill was before the CNRA committee. The land selection bill for the new borough of Wrangell was before the committee. We have an opportunity to review a pretty wide range of issues, but issues that are very important to Southeast Alaska. So I'm very happy with this committee.
Munoz is one of five Southeast House members. Haines Republican Bill Thomas co-chairs the Finance Committee. Wrangell Republican Peggy Wilson chairs the Transportation Committee. And Juneau Democrat Beth Kurtula is minority leader. The upcoming lame duck session of Congress could yield key tweaks to federal health care law. Northwest Regional Director of Congressional Public Affairs for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Renee Sinclair, told local Fairbanks chamber members yesterday that Congress will likely deal with the continuing decline in Medicare reimbursement for doctors.
Reimbursement rates will be cut again December 1st by 23%. If Congress doesn't deal with this issue in the lame duck session. So this is an issue that they are expected to deal with fairly quickly.
The difference between cost of service and Medicare reimbursement limits doctors' willingness to see Medicare patients nationwide, including in Alaska. Sinclair also warned local business owners of a provision in the Health Care Reform Act passed last spring that's aimed at bringing in more tax revenue.
That would require businesses to file a 1099 for every transaction of $600 or more per year that they engage in business-to-business activity.
Sinclair said the government is trying to tax an estimated $17 billion in unreported business-to-business transactions, but described the provision as a monumental paperwork burden for businesses and the Internal Revenue Service. Sinclair says there's some energy to get the provision repealed during the lame duck session. Sinclair also highlighted a number of other things Congress would consider during the session, including immigration law, campaign finance disclosure, and defense spending. She said climate change legislation will likely be delayed until the new Congress convenes next year, and that the newly elected Republican majority U.S. House will pose a big challenge to the president's agenda.
I think they will fight efforts to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, and certainly Senator Murkowski last year did yeoman's work in trying to get the Senate to stop what the Environmental Protection Agency was attempting to do.
Sinclair said the Environmental Protection Agency proposal would regulate greenhouse gas emissions of large office buildings and homes and family farms under the Clean Air Act. The National Guardsmen in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta made history last week by successfully completing their first jump training in the region since they were transformed into an airborne battalion. The parachute training was the first of its kind for many reasons, but it won't be the last. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
The sound of a Black Hawk helicopter is vibrating inside the National Guard hangar. Guardsmen are lined up, waiting to get a final equipment check from Captain Jeff Preston.
Right now I'm just checking the static line, make sure that there's no oil or debris or cuts in this the static line. This is what actually deploys the chute.
In moments, these guardsmen from the YK Delta will load into the Black Hawk, and once in the air, they'll jump back out.
Pretty much everything is unique. A lot of the guys haven't jumped helicopters before. Quite a few jumps under my belt. I've never jumped into the snow. This is the first jump on this drop zone. It was just surveyed. I think it's the first jump into Bethel in decades.
Preston is part of the Alpha Company based in Texas. His company was recently put under the same battalion as the Bravo Company based in Bethel.
We're really trying to be more of a national asset, and we've been trained together, trying to build a rapport with one another.
The retooled Bravo Company officially stood up last May. Bethel Guardsman Eric Pavel is part of that company. Jumping from aircraft is becoming part of his regular workday.
It's part of our job to be proficient in airborne operations.
The Bravo Company has jumped several times downstates, but Pavel says this jump is special.
Because you get to have your family and friends here locally see exactly what you do.
Bravo Company has jumped in places like Texas and Alabama, but as Pavel waits to jump now, it's about 20 degrees outside and it's much colder with the wind.
Your adrenaline's pumping. The cold really isn't going to affect you because you got other things in your mind.
Now loaded with guardsmen, the Black Hawk begins circling at about 1,000 feet above the tundra near the old BIA school. Ground teams hope for the best, but they're prepared for the worst. The first team jumps, and the horizon is filled with men dangling from green parachutes. The wind spreads them out as they land on the tundra. Specialist David Nanning of Bethel says it's his job to pick them up in a specialized vehicle called a SUSV. It moves on tracks much like a tank, but it's made for transportation. Nanning says it's ideal for this country.
It could go in the river and it floats, you know, lakes, rivers, the tundra. You know, we've been going through the tundra and I don't think it ever got stuck.
One person Nanning did not have to pick up was Sergeant Simon Black, originally from Hooper Bay. During the second wave of jumps, Black floated right over the parking area where the soldiers waited. But that was not his plan.
As soon as I jumped out of the helicopter, the wind caught me, so I started going a lot faster. I knew I would start going a little too far and to the side, and as soon as, like within 100 feet to the ground, I knew I was getting too close to the wire.
That's a telephone wire. Onlookers watched as Simon came floating towards it. He had a choice to try and drop altitude or try and clear it. He says he made a split-second decision.
I decided to just let the wind take me over, and I cleared it.
How close was it?
Inches. It was inches. I actually felt the wire. It was crazy.
Unscathed, Simon won't soon forget the experience.
It's awesome. It's just full of adventure.
Meanwhile, Nanning, who's parked in his SUSV, says he's waiting for his chance to jump. He says he was sidelined this go-around with an injury, but he's still happy to be part of the Bravo Company's landmark mission.
You know, in the future, I could look back and be like, you know, I was one of those soldiers. You know, so far we accomplished the first jump here in Bethel. And there's going to be plenty more to come.
I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
The University of Alaska showed improvement in enrollment, student retention, research funding, and other areas this year, and the economy may be part of the reason. Some of the statistics outlined in annual performance assessments at UA's three main campuses reflect economic factors. University of Alaska Fairbanks Provost and Executive Vice Chair for Academic Affairs, Susan Henricks, says recessions tend to generate students.
People who have some financial resources but can't get jobs will often go back to school in order to enhance their qualifications and hopefully prepare themselves better as for getting a job once the economy improves.
Henrick says increased federal grant and loan availability helped further bolster university enrollment in a state where there's minimal needs-based financial aid. She says the tough economy is also likely playing into decreasing the number of UA students transferring to outside institutions.
Even though people feel our tuition has been perhaps increasing more than they would like to see, it still is not particularly high, especially when you compare how much people would have to pay if they went outside and had to pay non-resident tuition at an institution in Washington or Oregon.
The economy has also affected research funding as federal stimulus dollars trickle down to the university, especially at research-focused UAF. Henrick says research funding at UAF went from $110 million in 2009 to $118 million this year.
Some of that was because of ARRA, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which provided extra funding to a lot of the federal agencies that fund our research.
Henrick says that money benefits the local economies because research dollars ultimately get spent on people, goods, and services. State officials say an invasive species of sea squirt has been found in Sitka's Whiting Harbor. The small invertebrate is known as a tunicate. It was discovered for the first time in Alaska when volunteers and scientists conducted a bio blitz in Sitka last June. Test results came back in August, confirming the tunicates as a species not native to Sitka Sound. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
The invasive tunicate is properly known as Didemnum vexillum, or DVEX for short. It sort of resembles something out of a science fiction movie.
Every one of you watching this screen, look out. Because soon, very soon, the most horrifying monster menace ever conceived will be oozing into this theater.
That's the trailer from the 1958 film The Blob. In the movie, a red mass of goo from outer space attacks the residents of a rural Pennsylvania town, growing and growing as it engulfs everything in its path. The invasive tunicate growing underneath the waters of Sitka Sound is not from outer space, but
similar to the blob in that it's just going to spread over anything that it can.
Tammy Davis is the project leader for the Invasive Species Program in the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
We've seen it growing on seaweed. We've seen it growing on kelp and rocks and shellfish.
And when it covers those things, like clams and mussels, they can't open up and feed.
The other concern is that by carpeting the seafloor and carpeting seaweed, we're concerned that any fish that rely on seaweed, eelgrass, for some part of their life cycle would be impacted.
And that could have an impact on commercial and traditional resources, such as fish, herring roe, and kelp. ADF&G is asking the public to help out by reporting sightings of the tunicates to its invasive species hotline, 1-877-INVASIVE. Take a picture if you can and note the GPS coordinates of the tunicate. Davis says members of the public should not try to remove the tunicate. One reason is that it's easily confused with native species that are supposed to be here.
The other reason is that because it is such a successful reproducer, should you leave behind a fragment or fragments while you're trying to take that, it could break apart and then now you've got spread instead of control.
DVEX was recently sighted along the Oregon coast in May. It's also been found in Washington and British Columbia for a few years now. The state of Washington dropped $850,000 to manage the problem in Puget Sound. Right now, Alaska officials are still figuring out how widespread this underwater blob is, and they're hoping to prevent the marine equivalent of that 1958 movie scenario.
From then on, there's no stopping the blob as it spreads from town to town.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. From Kodiak to Kosigluk to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
Richard Nelson, anthropologist and host of Encounters, is coming to Anchorage as part of the Alaska News Fund Speakers Series, bringing public broadcasting faces to Alaska. Richard Nelson will be in Anchorage at the Anchorage Museum Auditorium on Friday, November 12th. For ticket information, go to APRN.org or call 550-8400. Proceeds will benefit APRN Alaska News Fund.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.